This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The Canadian government's been accused of muzzling its scientists. Delegates at a major science meeting said that communication of important research on environmental and health issues is being suppressed.
You just heard the BBC starting its report on how Canadian government scientists are often forbidden to speak to the press, even after publishing studies in major international journals. We'll hear three shocking cases explained by Canada's top science reporter, Margaret Munro. It's not just Canada. Here is NASA's top climate scientist, Dr. James Hansen, speaking at a special presentation at the 2012 meeting of the American Academy for the Advancement of Science with moderator Frank Sesno.
Jim, I have a question for you from the audience. How can scientists navigate government instructions to keep quiet on issues such as climate change? How can scientists avoid letting themselves be muzzled?
It's easy but difficult because there are consequences. I mean,
you've experience with this?
Yeah, and it's a trade-off, you know. So, well, when I was being muzzled, I waited a couple of weeks, 3 weeks, and let the events occur, so I had a track record to show that I had been prevented from being on NPR and had been prevented from talking to Los Angeles Times reporter.
And where was the muzzling coming from?
It was coming from public affairs at NASA headquarters, who had been called, NASA headquarters had been called by the White House. So it was fairly easy to then for me to inform New York Times, this is what's happening. And then it got on the front page of the New York Times. But there are consequences. As a result, shortly thereafter, the first line of the NASA mission statement to understand and protect our home planet disappeared. And the funding for Earth Science R&D was decreased retroactively 20% to the beginning of the fiscal year.
The right of experts to speak out has improved slightly in the United States since George Bush gave way to the Obama administration. Francesco Griffo of the Union of Concerned Scientists reveals how information important to your safety was suppressed by industry lobbyists. As the outgoing president of the AAAS, Dr. Nina Fedorov, told a press conference in Vancouver, belief systems, especially when tinged with fear, are not easily dispersed with facts. She said, as a result of a campaign of misinformation through the mainstream media and the net in America, quote, fewer people believe in climate change each year, end quote. Fedorov told reporters, quote, I'm scared to death because that obviously stalls what we need to be doing to adapt to climate change, end quote. She continued, quote, we are sliding back into a dark era, and there seems to be little we can do about it. I am profoundly depressed at just how difficult it has become merely to get a realistic conversation started on issues such as climate change or genetically modified organisms, end quote, from Nina Fedorov. That ends up with statements like this from Republican candidate Rick Santorum.
It's about some phony ideal. Some phony theology. Oh, not a theology based on the Bible, different theology.
I referred to global warming as not climate science, but political science. We were put on this earth as creatures of God to have dominion over the earth, to use it wisely and steward it wisely, but for our benefit, not for the earth's benefit.
I've never supported even the hoax of global warming, the scientific hoax of global warming.
Santorum is just part of a race to the bottom, as all candidates deny global warming and often science in general, including evolution. But first, the fossil fuel industry has combined with some very wealthy ideologues to make you doubt global warming is happening or that we are facing big changes in the climate. For years, we guessed and partly knew that a small group of right-wing think tanks, weathermen and bloggers, and even a couple of low-grade climate scientists were being paid off. We just couldn't see through the corporate veil of deception. Now we know that many of the same people hired by the tobacco industry to create doubt that smoking killed millions of people found a new source of funding and a new cause attacking climate science and the scientists. Hidden money fueled a campaign of lies, innuendo, and fear-mongering. In our recent news, we finally got hard information on just who is paying for these attacks and how the money flows out of so-called independent experts and bloggers. A well-known scientist penetrated the secret funding sources for the climate attack's central place, an alleged charity called the Heartland Institute. Dr. Peter H. Gleick is co-founder and president of the Pacific Institute for Studies in Development, Environment, and Security in Oakland, California. After receiving an anonymous strategy document thought to be from the Heartland Institute, Gleick added himself to a mailing list for Heartland directors. The documents emailed to him confirmed our worst suspicions. Wealthy philanthropists and fossil fuel companies were funding a network of climate denial, not just in the United States, but in Canada, New Zealand, Australia, and possibly the UK. It was all tax-deductible, paid by American taxpayers. We didn't really need the Heartland emails leaked to dsmogblog.com. Another source, Dr. John Mashey, patiently analyzed public documents to track it all down. Let's talk with him now. Here is some friendly advice for climate deniers. Hope that Dr. John Mashey doesn't notice you. Last summer, Radio EcoShock ran a presentation by Dr. Mashey on his detailed investigation into the funding of the alleged institutes and self-proclaimed experts who say global warming doesn't exist and who promote the interests of fossil fuel companies. John Mashey is one of America's top computer experts with a history in Bell Labs and in Silicon Valley. Now he applies his skills outing those who attack climate science and scientists. Dr. Mashey, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Hey, thanks a lot, Alex.
It's been a hot time for one of the worst offenders, the Heartland Institute. Is your new report based on the leaked internal documents showing their billionaire funders and intentions?
No, I had no connection with it, oddly. Certainly what appeared in that leak was not very much of a surprise to me, actually, because I had seen most of the sorts of things before. So, in fact, from my point of view, the timing was really not very good. I would have much preferred if somebody was going to do that they had waited a few weeks. So I, in fact, had capped off this 200-plus page report, had prepared a complaint to the IRS the night before, and then last Tuesday, all crazy chaos broke loose.
Right, indeed it did. And I took time to go through that 200-page outline about the front groups who attack climate science, and I found it, listeners, at dsmogblog.com. It seems incredible. Big corporations and wealthy family foundations put out propaganda through tax-deductible charity foundations. How do they do that?
Well, that's the interesting question, you see, is In fact, a lot of this dates back to the tobacco wars. And, of course, I go into that in some detail. I'm afraid that tobacco companies built machinery and tactics for confusing people about science. And they tried quite often to get that message out through every venue they could. And one batch of think tanks was perfectly happy to take their money for years. And fortunately, all that's recorded in the tobacco archives. One digs around and knows the right questions, you can find amazing history there. Thing is, they built this machinery, and then that same machinery has been applied to other things, like various environmental problems, and including climate change. So sort of people got a lot of practice doing this, and then perhaps the tobacco money went down a little bit. There was something else to do.
And one of those tobacco guys who's now an anti-climate man is Fred Singer, and he's often listed as being from the University of Virginia. Why does that university put up with him?
Well, because he's actually an emeritus professor, and that title in some cases sticks forever. And in fact, he hasn't really been attached to the university, as far as I can tell, since around 1994. You know, some emeritus professors, I live just next to Stanford, and I know a lot of them, are very active, still working either in their own areas, or they maybe shift to a new career. There's a great Nobel Prize winner named Burton Richter who shifted from particle physics over into climate and energy and still contributes. But Fred's been long gone from Virginia. The trouble is, there's not much they can do if he, as long as he sticks the emeritus on his name, which he often doesn't.
And Fred Singer listed a dead man as the chair of his supposed charity. Is that right?
That is correct. For 2 years after Frederick Seitz was dead, he was listed in the official IRS forms, handwritten by Fred the Singer, as working an hour a week, which leads me to think, well, maybe Fred Singer has a good spirit medium or something. I'm not sure what. But I will say this, Seitz was listed as getting zero pay.
Well, talk to us about the Heartland Institute. Why don't we start with their efforts to push anti-science in the classrooms of the United States and in Canada?
Yes, well, that was actually one of the things in this that came up in this recent leak was this plan to build a curriculum, actually written by someone who's not a climate scientist, that would, you know, be able to be injected into the schools. And many people were really surprised at this. I wasn't, because I had read through 1,700 pages of their environment and climate newsletter, and they had a long history of trying to push these views into the schools, not very successfully, and they sort of alluded to that in the leaked funding report. So they've been doing this for years. They started with a campaign, is your child being indoctrinated or educated? The first one was a picture of a sweet young girl with some books. Apparently that didn't work so well, so they switched to a picture of Al Gore. Maybe that would stir people up. But even further back in 2002 or so, they were telling their readers, share articles from this with your child or even with your school teachers. So they review kids' books. You can guess they like some kids' books and they really dislike others. They had a series of videos they tried to put out. And if you go read my article called Faked Education at DSmog Blog, it's got a pointer to a 5-minute video trailer that is just, you know, a thing you must see.
Right, and I see from your charts, and it was echoed in the leaked documents, that the Heartland Institute received millions from a single anonymous donor. Do we have any clues who that is?
Oh, yeah. Well, it's pretty well in the blogs, and it is something I almost included, but I still had some work to do to track a few things down. The leaked information helped remove certain possibilities. I would suggest that there is huge amount of evidence that it's, and I don't know how to pronounce it, it's Barry Seed, it's B-A-R-R-E-S-E-I-D, from Chicago area. And there's a whole pattern of him giving to Heartland for years, and then through his foundation, at least back through 1999. But around 2005, he disappears. There's a funny thing in 2005, 2006, where a whole lot more money comes in, and then the next year it goes out to a bunch of different other nonprofits. Heartland had never done that before or afterwards. One of them was to a place called Scheimer College, and it turns out that there was a takeover attempt sort of run by Saeed with a new board, or attempting to have a new board, which was mostly people who worked for Saeed or people who were funded by Saeed. And then later, what happens is the money comes to Scheimer College through this donors trust, donors capital combination. And that entity also supplied a lot of money to Heartland. That's the big boost, came through donors. And so I can't prove beyond a shadow of a doubt, but I would bet, you know, there's nobody else that fits. And in particular, the other possibilities were all named as named donors in the funding document, which says, you know, pretty unlikely.
Well, right. You found a lot of money that was named coming from the likes of Exxon, Mobil, Chevron, BP, Amoco, the Koch brothers, and even, surprise, surprise, the government-owned General Motors. Is this how the oil industry hides its attack on climate science?
Yeah, the way I would put it is, so you guys play a similar brand of football in Canada, and you know, what I put it is that the ExxonMobil especially got the play going and then did a handoff to the big family foundations. Now, of course, the Koch brothers are both big oil and foundation. But some of this, like Saeed, it seems to be pure ideology. They're willing to take up the cudgels for this. So the thing is, I think, you know, ExxonMobil Foundation sort of dropped out of this in the mid-2000s because they got a lot of criticism. Now, frankly, I was surprised that they ever did it through the foundation because the amounts are minuscule compared to their daily profits. Of course, you understand corporations can always donate directly. None of that showed up in this. So it may well be that they did a lot of seed funding starting especially around 1998. And that was, you know, there was a group put together by the American Petroleum Institute that was covered in one of my earlier reports, you know, with the head lobbyist, Randy Randall from ExxonMobil, and Fred Singer's wife, and the folks from Competitive Enterprise Institute, that whole gang. And it seemed like they got the ball rolling and then stepped back. Why not? If somebody else will go pay for it, the corporations don't spend money they don't need to.
And many of these groups, John, told the U.S. Internal Revenue Service that they don't do any lobbying of politicians. And is that true?
Well, let me distinguish two kinds of things that I particularly looked at in my big report. There's the kind of thing where you violate the rules for nonprofits by advocating all sorts of things that are not fact-based, that are sort of emotionally based, that tax on other people, like there were about 10 use of alarmist per issue of this climate news, right? There was like 880 mentions of alarmist. Now, lobbying is a grayer zone, and it's harder to prove because, after all, the best lobbying is sort of one-on-one kinds of things, right? But Heartland has a long history, and I showed a whole lot of examples where they brag about their access to legislators. They talk about the newsletters mostly going to legislators, state and local, across the country. They quote things where they say legislators changed their mind. You know, what percentage of them changed their mind as a result of reading their newsletters. They have these little dinners where they pay for government officials to come, and otherwise, they're for their big donors. Now, you know, would you guess that the big donors sit at separate tables from the legislators? Probably not, right? But, you know, they mention things where they give presentations to representatives, and they bring non-experts, but they claim they're experts. Anyway, that's a harder thing to prove. What was clear was their IRS forms always said that they did none of this. And, you know, nonprofits are allowed to do a certain amount of it, but they also have to say what money they spend and how much effort they do. And, you know, Heartland just continually bragged to its advertisers, to its donors, of how much access it had to state and local governments.
And where does your investigation go from here? Has the IRS responded in any way?
I haven't heard from them, but I wouldn't have expected to yet. It's only been a week, so. Now, you know, I sent them a note, appropriate note, and pointed them at this, I told them a report was coming because I sent this, you know, before it was up. And then I have since told them exactly where it was and mentioned the leaked material. But again, leaked material, I could have done perfectly well without it, but it was interesting to see that they inter-corroborated each other quite well.
Well, I don't want you to give away any secrets, but what still needs to be done to expose what looks to me like money laundering that goes through for climate denial and who pays for it all? What are you looking at next?
Oh, yeah. Well, so let me try. There were more things that were on my list to go look at, like tracking down where exactly the money was coming through that flowed through donors' trust. But in fact, you know, I found already things that look like four or five deep funding chains where the money moved around, right? And in particular, I noticed that there were a number of grants made to foreign entities that, in fact, were not charities. And that, by the way, is a serious no-no to the IRS. And there were two entities in Canada, one of which was not a charity, and there were two entities, well, sort of in New Zealand, although it sort of semi-migrated to Canada in a peculiar way. Then there were a bunch of unspecified things that went probably to Australia, maybe even to India. There's some dotted lines that connect things pretty well. Like for instance, Joanne Nova made this thing called the Skeptics Handbook, which is just, you know, ridiculous anti-science. And Heartland gave out 14,000 copies to school board presidents in the U.S. I don't know if any got up to Canada, but they were all over the U.S. They even mocked one of the presidents who rejected it kind of vocally. So there's a pretty strong dotted line there. Now, I can't find that out because, you know, it's material they don't have to make public, but the IRS knows. So we'll see.
All right. Well, as we wrap up, did I miss anything that you would like to add?
Well, I think just one thing here. One of the things I did in the report was to show a chart on page 3, I think it was, of the funders at the top, who they funded amongst a group of about a dozen think tanks, and then how not just Heartland and Fred Singer's place and the Center for the Study of Carbon Dioxide and Global Change, but a bunch of other think tanks. And what you find is that in Heartland's documentation that they put out, you find people from those other think tanks often contributing ideas, wrong arguments typically, to the material Heartland puts out. Or they're part of Heartland's NIPCC reports or Heartland's global warming experts that are sent to legislators. So, you know, what you find is it's the same group funding all this stuff, and it's a bunch of nonprofits that manage to generate all this disinformation. And so part of the thing, I think, is to explore more of the money paths and what goes on. You know what these guys do, too, is I have this term fakesperts. They all quote each other back and forth or write articles, all quoting each other or using each other's stuff, all claiming each other are distinguished experts, right? And it's, you know, I know a lot of real experts, you know, members of the National Academy and folks like that. And I'm afraid none of these are real experts.
Well, there you have it. Like a kind of superhero for science, Dr. John Mashey tracks down the money trail and helps protect climate science, I think, and scientists. So, John, please keep me posted. Let's talk again.
We will, and I would just like to end. You know, I was up in British Columbia last April and had a terrific trip, thanks to PIX, and was glad to talk to you then and now.
All right, and you can find out more at dsmogblog.com. Dr. John Mashey is spelled M-A-S-H-E-Y. Do find out more. It's pretty interesting stuff. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock, now broadcast by over 60 college and community radio stations in the United States, Canada, Britain, and Australia. I'm Alex Smith saying, as we head into a crisis of energy, economy, and the environment, we need alternative voices more than ever. Please support your local nonprofit station. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. Fossil fuel industries and anti-climate fanatics go further than funding fake charities and buying fake experts. They use big campaign donations to buy off governments as well. The governments then order their own scientists not to talk to the press or intervene with public relations agents to rewrite scientific conclusions. That is another reason why you hear so little about the massive threat climate change poses to us now and in all coming generations. The American Academy for the Advancement of Science is so concerned about attacks on climate science and scientists, they held a special session called Unmuzzling Government Scientists, How to Reopen the Discourse, in Vancouver on February 17, 2012. From that session, here is one of the few Canadian climate scientists willing and able to speak out, IPCC lead author and University of Victoria professor Dr. Andrew Weaver, quoting from a work of Canadian journalist Mike D'Souza.
Prime Minister Stephen Harper's government introduced new rules to control interviews with journalists by Environment Canada scientists in 2007 that resulted in an 80% drop in media coverage of climate change science, according to an internal analysis that was released in 2010.
That's right. Most Canadians can't even name three Canadian climate scientists. They've hardly heard from them. Canadian reporters have almost given up asking the government for interviews as Prime Minister Stephen Harper rams through the tar sands operations and the Alberta oil industry he represents. Here is a short talk from Canada's top climate science reporter, Margaret Munro, for Post Media. Then we'll get an update on the situation in the United States.
As Catherine mentioned, I've been a longtime science in Canada, and I've been able to witness this pretty remarkable change that's happened. We used to have a very open system of government where the scientists were actually free to discuss the research with the media. But it's now become a very closed system, with government taking media and message control to, in sometimes quite incredible extremes. And we're not talking about state secrets here. There have been several cases where the scientists have not been allowed to discuss studies that they've published in research journals. And I'm going to run through some examples. But before I tell you about how bad it's become in here in Canada, I want to tell you a bit about how good it used to be. There are thousands of government scientists, and they study everything from the Arctic ice to safety of food and medicines, and they basically do science in the public interest. And not so long ago, you could actually phone them up and talk to them. You know, you say you want to do a story on their work, and they were often keen, often encouraged, to actually do the interviews with the reporters. And, you know, it could happen quite quickly. You could phone them up, and within an hour, you'd be interviewing these people. It was quite an open system. And this is the kind of story and attention they used to attract. So this story ran in the Times Colonist in February 2007. And those are four government scientists, with Andrew here is on the second from the left. The scientists were involved in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. They were all authors, co-authors of it. And so we just wanted to do a story on the Canadian involvement in the IPCC. And I phoned them up, said it, told them the story we wanted to do. And they said, sure, come on over. I flew over. We interviewed them. Went down, took some pictures, came back. The story runs in the newspapers across the country. One of the interesting things about this story is that, as you can see, the federal scientist, like Ken Denman, whose quote is in the top there, he was not only allowed to talk about his science, but he felt free to actually give his own personal opinion that we have to act to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So, as I say, that was early 2007. By the end of the year, things had changed pretty dramatically. All of a sudden, when you'd phone a federal scientist, Environment Canada scientist, they'd either not call you back or they'd say, I can't talk to you. You've got to go through Ottawa now. We have had a change of policy. And invariably, you'd end up in the hands of one of these media handlers from Ottawa who would phone you back or send you an email. And they'd say, okay, what's the story? They want the questions in writing. They'd say, submit your questions. And then invariably, they get back to you and say, oh, you can't talk to that person. And here's some. And they'd often give you scripted lines that, you know, approved lines that you could use. So I started asking around, and because I thought, well, this is quite a big change. So I started asking around, and a source inside government leaked us this document here, which is laid out the new media protocol for the Environment Canada. As you can see, it's dated from November 2007. And it's several pages long, but I just brought up along a couple of the key pages. So here's one that gives the rationale, and it says, just as we have one department, one website, we should have one department, one voice. Now, science sort of depends on debate and discussion, right? And if you only have one voice, you don't have a skeptical voice, and you don't have proper debate. So I have a bit of a problem with that, but my bigger problem is where this part of it is how it's going to work. It says, media relations at national headquarters will coordinate all the media calls coming into the department. So as a reporter who actually works in Vancouver, I find this a bit frustrating. Like, so if you don't make your call before 1 o'clock, you are waiting until the next day. But that's minor compared to the third point there, where it talks about how the program experts are going to respond with approved lines. Now, approved lines are laundered and scripted lines. And the program experts are actually the scientists. So basically, we've got the PR people now are telling the scientists and working with them. And like it's not like they seem to jump ahead of the scientists in terms of who's making the decisions here. So anyway, we did a big story on this, and it was front page news across the country. There was all kinds of editorials and outrage about the people saying, you know, they shouldn't be muzzling the scientists. But basically, the government just sat out the controversy, and the policy stayed in force, for the most part, in Environment Canada. And it soon spread to other science-based departments. And no one has ever really explained, to my knowledge, the need for this policy. But it fits with other changes that the Harper government has made. You know, this government has got a reputation for obsessive media and message control. The government now has like a small army of people crafting and vetting media lines and doing media strategy in Ottawa. There's apparently 4,459 information officers, media handlers, and strategists working for the federal government. And it's pretty clear that for federal scientists, Ottawa decides now if the researchers can talk, what they can talk about, and when they can say it. And when interviews are approved, they're often tape-recorded by minders in Ottawa, which has got to be, I think, pretty intimidating for some of these scientists, because the government's in the midst of slashing budgets, and it really doesn't like people doing a lot of talking with the media. So it's not a good situation. And there's been lots of controversy about it over the last few years. One of the cases involved this fellow, Dr. Scott Dalimore. He works in Victoria. But here he is standing in front of melting permafrost up on the Beaufort Sea in the Arctic. So in the Mackenzie Delta, up by the Beaufort Sea. Now, he works for the Geological Survey of Canada, and he's a gifted communicator. Scott has done dozens of medias with international, national media over the years, and he was a guy that you could phone him up, and he was sort of authorized to talk to the media almost. You know, he could answer your questions, and he didn't get into politics. He would stick to the science, but he was a very accessible guy, like many senior scientists in the government were. But that all changed for Scott and his department, actually, in April 2010, when Scott Dalimore and his colleagues published this study in the journal Nature. It's about a flood in Canada's north that happened 13,000 years ago. There's nothing controversial about this study, but Dalimore was told he couldn't speak to reporters without permission from Ottawa. And as government documents later showed, Dr. Dalimore needed to get permission from his political minister's office in Ottawa. And he didn't get the minister's permission in time to do interviews on the flood study. And when this got out, it generated a lot of controversy. People called it Orwellian, and there's all kinds of editorials. Here you have the Vancouver Sun said it offended the principle of public service. The Saskatoon Star Phoenix said, when you have to assess the implications for the minister of a flood that happened 13,000 years ago, you know that government information control has gone too far. And then last year, there was an even more bizarre case involving this woman, Dr. Christine Miller. She's a federal fishery scientist, and she led a study that was published in the journal Science on sockeye salmon. That's these guys. There's a lot of concern about these fish. They're a very famed and valuable fish here on the West Coast. And a lot of them, like huge numbers of them, are some years do not make it to the spawning grounds. So her study that was published in Science, it suggested that viral infections might explain why so many of these fish were dying before they had a chance to spawn. And the study was published January 14th, 2011. And 5 days before that, the Science's media office in Washington, it highlighted her study in their press pack that goes to thousands of reporters around the world. And this gives reporters several days to prepare the story before the embargoes lift on the study. So there was plenty of interest in this. Lots of journalists phoned up asking for interviews. There was people from Time, Wired, the Globe and Mail, CBC, lots of others. And they were all told by the media office at the Department of Fisheries here in Vancouver that Dr. Miller would be available, that they were going to arrange interviews, but we just have to wait a bit, but there would be interviews. But the days ticked by, and the reporters' deadlines came and went, and Dr. Miller, we never heard from her. She was not available to give interviews. And it was so strange, particularly because the government had said she'd be available. I thought, what is going on? So I filed an access to information request asking for the documents relating to her study. And 6 months later, almost 800 pages of documents were released. 800 pages were released in response to the ATI request. They gave a glimpse of this elaborate approval, or in the case of Dr. Miller, a disapproval process that she had to go through. The documents show how she'd wanted to talk to the media about her study, but she needed several layers of approval in Ottawa. First from the media office at the Department of Fisheries and Oceans, then the Deputy Minister's Office at Fisheries and Oceans, then from the Fisheries Minister's Office, and then it had to go over to the Privy Council Office, which is an arm of the Prime Minister's Office. It would be sort of like asking the White House if you can talk about a fish study. So the documents show that she got approval all the way up to her Fisheries Minister's Office, but it was when it landed over at the Privy Council Office that all of a sudden the brakes went on and said, no, you cannot do the interview. And they also nixed a press release, and it said the study was too focused on dying salmon. So here we have a situation where the government knew weeks in advance that this study was coming out, and they could not get their act together to know whether or not she was going to be able to do interviews, to have a press release or anything. And the reporters were just so frustrated. This is a note that went, there's several notes that went back and forth between Greg Rasmussen, who's a national CBC reporter, and Diane Lake, who's the PR officer here in Vancouver for DFO. And as you can see at the bottom, he's like, what's happening to this interview? And it went on for 3 days, if you go all the way to the bottom. And at the end, on the 13th, which is the day the embargo lifts on the study, he says, you know, what is going on over there, right? What's the problem at your end? Like, I need to do this interview in, like, the next few minutes. At any rate, he never got the interview, and neither did anyone else. So when the story broke last summer on who had actually muzzled her, it was pretty big news out here in Vancouver. And it caught controversy, more editorials, you know, saying that here you have the treatment of one of the leading fisheries biologists reflects a worrisome disregard for the importance of neutral scientific facts, unfettered by political spin. And that was from the Ottawa Citizen. Then we had another case just last fall involving Environment Canada scientists who were co-authors. There's several Canadian co-authors on this paper about last year's unprecedented ozone hole up in the Arctic. Dr. David Tarasak works for Environment Canada, and he and his colleagues launched these are ozone sondes, but they basically carry instruments up several kilometers up into the atmosphere, and they can monitor how the chemicals are changing in the atmosphere. So we wanted to do a story on the study, and we wanted to talk to the Canadian authors. So I sent an email off to, I phoned Dr. Tarasak. He said, oh, I would talk to you, but you need to talk to the media office first. So I sent the little note off to the media office, and I, with the questions, according to their rules. And, you know, I sort of waited. And as you can see from this email here, I'd asked on the 27th for interviews and I submitted my questions. They waited till the 29th to get back to me saying, thanks for your inquiry. While the interview cannot be granted, we can give you this response. And they give us all this blue stuff here. This is the comments that we can attribute to Dr. Tarasek. So they never explain why there was no interview. You just can't do the interview. And this is pretty normal practice for the federal government, and particularly for Environment Canada. So again, we just pointed this out in our story. And again, more headlines, more people decrying what was going on. And it came up in Parliament that the Environment Minister, Peter Kent, got really questioned on the muzzling of the scientists. It got pretty heated over this issue. But the government just stuck it out, as they say. But then, in a weird twist in this one, a few weeks later, Environment Canada, following the media office, said, oh, you can speak to Dr. Tarasek now. Like, the story has come and gone, right? But it's like, you can speak to Dr. Tarasek now. I wasn't available to do it, but one of my colleagues in Ottawa, Mike D'Souza, he did an interview with him. And again, he had to submit his questions in writing. But when he's getting to the end, he asked him, so why couldn't you talk about the study when the study actually came out? And he said, well, I'm available when media relations says I'm available, and I have to go through them. Now, I know this is very frustrating. Oh, and again, more editorials about the whole thing. So this is frustrating for the scientists, and it's incredibly frustrating for journalists. And I know several reporters who, you know, they just don't even bother approaching the federal government anymore to talk to scientists, because you end up very frustrated. So what has and can be done about this? Well, science writers and journalists, like, this is not just common to science journalists, and this happens to, like, a lot of political reporters are getting nowhere in Ottawa as well. So there's been a lot of public discussion about this, and there's been letters, and there was an open letter sent by the Canadian science writers to the political leaders last year asking to restore access to the scientists. But the government, for the most part, won't really admit there's a problem. They maintain that there is timely, orderly access to scientists, which I disagree with. There's been a lot of controversy, and I do think it's helping. I think there's this pushback has actually got the government to the point where sometimes you can interview scientists. Like, you phone up and everyone's like, it's so surprising that they actually can talk to you. But it's very hit and miss, and there doesn't seem to be much rhyme or reason to when they do it. And they are in charge, and it's very opaque what the policy is here. As I say, I think it's very important to document these examples, so I would encourage any and all journalists to document it and help us, you know, sort of try to restore access, because I really believe that science journalism, or just journalism, depends, just like science does, on the free flow of information. And I'll stop there.
Thank you very much, Margaret Monroe.
That was Margaret Monroe, science reporter for the Canadian newspaper chain Post Media. Recordings from this session are courtesy of AVEN, the audio-visual education network, at aven.com.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
The printed program for this session lists a third panelist representing the Canadian government, namely Claire Dansereau, the Deputy Minister for the Department of Fisheries and Oceans. She didn't show up. The AAAS left an empty chair, symbolic of this government's unwillingness to speak or to face its critics. Obviously, the government agreed to come, but failed to show up, and that about says it all. Here is another crazy example. The supposedly neutral government called opponents of the proposed Enbridge Northern Pipeline unpatriotic, foreign-funded radicals. These radicals include pretty well every Aboriginal nation along the route from the tar sands and a majority of the Canadian public opposed to the pipeline. To make sure no one talks too much at the environmental impact hearings, the government imposed Orwellian rules. In procedural directive number 4, the panel ruled oral evidence should not include the following: technical or scientific information, opinions, views, information, or perspectives of others, detailed information on the presenter's views on the decisions of the panel, recommendations whether to approve or not to approve the project, or conditions that should be applied if the project were to proceed, or questions that the presenter wants answered. Presenter and federal member of Parliament Nathan Cullen, whose riding is most impacted by the would-be tar sands pipeline, was repeatedly interrupted and silenced by these rules of procedure. And by the way, most people only get 5 minutes to talk, no matter who they are. In other words, just shut up. Maybe you can talk about the weather. No science, no facts, no questions allowed. Is it any better for the American government-funded scientists now that Barack Obama has replaced oil man George Bush? Dr. Francesca Griffo reports to the AAAS conference.
Anyway, good morning and thank you. You know, it's just so strange because as I sat here listening to the previous talk, I thought, are we talking about the United States and Canada, or are we talking about some other crazy part of the world? I mean, it just doesn't seem like this should really be how it is here. But sadly, it is. So basically, what I wanted to do this morning was tell you very quickly a little bit about the situation that we found ourselves in the previous administration in the U.S., and then talk a little bit about the work that we've done to try and get ourselves out of that situation. And hopefully, although our governments are very different, you know, we do have this democracy thing in common, and hopefully you might gain some insights from that and, you know, help you along your journey to try and stop this. So I think, as was alluded to before, both democracy and science are very much based on the free flow of information. Part of what we expect from our governments in a democracy is accountability, and that accountability really comes from transparency. And that's what this is about at its core. This isn't about some abstract right that scientists get to chatter about anything they want. This is about important information that has critical repercussions for our health, our safety, our environment, our world, our future, our children's future, and the ability to get that information out there so that we as citizens can really begin to evaluate and be a part of the decision-making process. So that's kind of why this is important. We began our work on this topic a number of years ago in the Bush administration. My apologies to chemists in the audience. But we took a little bit of license with the periodic table of the elements. And if you were to go to our website and click on each one of these elements, you would get to a one-page summary of, you know, an incident of political interference in science with primary documents. One of my personal favorites is when we caught up one of our higher-ups, political appointees in the Department of Interior, making track changes in a Word document, which she left in the track changes, changing the science so that we would have a different decision on endangered species. So that's the sort of thing that's in there. Now, these examples for us really spanned very, very diverse issues. Beryllium, you know, pharmaceuticals, formaldehyde and plywood. I mean, you name it. If it was inconvenient for either the government or a donor to our previous government, they suppressed it or manipulated it. One very quick example, the lunchboxes, vinyl lunchboxes. One of the cheap ways to make that vinyl is to put lead in the vinyl. In our Consumer Product Safety Commission, they were doing tests on the vinyl. They got very high levels of lead. When they swiped, a supervisor came in and said to the scientist who was doing it, he said, "Oh my God, these levels are off the charts." And the supervisor said, "Well, what happens when you keep swiping?" And the scientist said, "Well, the levels go down." He said, "Good, keep doing that until you get an average that's within the legal limit." So that's the sort of thing that was going on. That's the lunchbox my kid was licking yogurt off the side of, right? Okay, and yours, perhaps. So many, many different examples. And in fact, one of the things that we did was to really, now our work focuses on, because we've made some progress across the federal agencies, which I'll talk about, we're now focusing on the drivers of that political interference. And it really is, you know, the corporate interference is huge for us in the U.S. And this is actually the cover of a report that we released today, and there are executive summaries over there. So the major flagship example, if you will, of this was, of course, Dr. Hansen, Goddard Space Institute, a part of NASA, who wanted to speak out about climate scientists and was muzzled. Now, the silly thing was that he turned out to be muzzled by a public affairs official who didn't even, it turned out, have a college degree. He'd lied on his resume. So anyway, but the point is, this was caused a very, very big kerfluffle and really began the conversation about this. And I will say that in response, even in the last administration, NASA did make some changes. But what we wanted to do was go out beyond this sort of an example to really look at this not as an anecdote, but as a trend. So what we began to do were actually surveys of scientists and federal agencies. And over the years, we surveyed some, you know, 15,000 scientists across five agencies. And what we found was this. This is very typical. Actually, we surveyed many more than this. 42% of the respondents that we had said they feared retaliations for speaking out about their agency's mission-driven work. And this was not only outside the agencies with the media, but this was also inside the agencies where the decisions were being made. So this was pretty awful. And we have a number of surveys of different agencies that we've done. EPA, our Environmental Protection Agency, our Food and Drug Administration, our U.S. Department of Agriculture, climate scientists, Fish and Wildlife Service scientists, so many, many different agencies that we looked at. And we found very similar results across those agencies. We then thought, okay, let's try to look at this in a little bit more depth. So we did another investigation where we looked at 15 federal regulatory and science agencies, and we examined their existing media policies, some of which we couldn't find. We have something similar to your, we call it our Freedom of Information Act request, where you can ask for these policies. And then we looked at, through interviews and, again, more surveys, the implementation of those policies. And what we found was not actually a very pretty picture. We did a scorecard. One of the things that we do is try to bring visibility to this issue, and this scorecard was quite successful. So on the left, you see the name of the agency, then you see what they got as a grade on the policy, and then in the right column, how that policy was actually being implemented. You see a lot of red. It wasn't good. And what we found was that very few agencies had decent policies. A few agencies had decent policies that weren't being fully implemented. And a couple of agencies actually had a pretty decent culture without having a policy, just simply because of the way that those agencies were run. And because if you look, you know, the agencies that did have a pretty good set of policies were those agencies that were pretty much purely scientific. Where you get the problems are where you have the science and the regulatory piece together in the same agency. As long as you have our U.S. Geological Survey, they don't have regulatory powers. They were being pretty much left alone. But of course, theoretically, this began to change when President Obama came to power. I guess he sort of has power, but came into office at any rate. Back in 2009, he promised immediately in his inauguration speech that he was going to restore science to its rightful place. We've spent a lot of time wondering what that actually means. But I think on the up and up, the trajectory is good. You know, they are really moving in the right direction, and we're quite happy about that. It's taken a little while. It was 2010 before our science advisor, Dr. John Holdren, very well-known climate scientist, actually came out with these guidelines for how to put together these scientific integrity policies for each of the agencies. Those policies have a number of different parts to them. We found as we briefed agencies and met with agencies across the federal government, we worked with between 15 and 20 agencies, that in fact they were quite confused as to what this meant and how it could work. So one of the first things we did was actually pull together this document, which all of this is on our website. You know, what we found was that piecemeal, here and there across the government, different agencies had little bits of it right. So we took that and pulled it together into this one document so that it was already written in federalese, and it made them much more confident in their ability to adapt it. The fact that it, you know, oh, look, Fish and Wildlife is actually doing that. You know, we can do it too. So this document, I think, was quite helpful as they went through and actually formulated these policies. Basically, what we're looking for and what we asked for in a public communications policy were these things. Personal views exception. This is what you were referring to earlier, which is, I still have First Amendment rights even though I work for the federal government, essentially. So you can speak about research results as a scientist representing your agency. But we get the fact that you cannot have every scientist across the federal government making policy. I mean, this is a really difficult thing to do. It would just be crazy. But what you can have is every scientist across the federal government taking off their scientist cap, putting it aside, putting on their citizen cap and saying, this is what I think these results mean. This is what I think we should do about this problem. And that's what we're asking for here. The second piece is the right of last review. What we also found, and I haven't heard this quite yet in Canada, is that a lot of documents would take the scientific research, rewrite it. It would come out in some other form bearing very little resemblance to the original scientific research results. So this is right of last review, so that before something like that is released to the public, if it's based substantively on the work of a scientist, that scientist gets to review it and make sure that it's still scientifically accurate. The third one, defined roles for public affairs officers and scientists. These folks are gatekeepers. I mean, these folks are, sorry, facilitators, not gatekeepers. In other words, they don't get to say yes or no to the interview, but they can be a partner. They can have a very important role at promoting the scientist, promoting the research results and so on, helping to write press releases. God knows, as scientists, we can use all the help we can get sometimes writing for other audiences. So we're not saying they don't have an important role, but it isn't a gatekeeper role by any means. And scientists, as a professional courtesy, should let them know when they do an interview. I mean, that's just the polite thing to do and a professional thing to do. Non-disclosure agreements, what we also found were many scientists were being asked to sign these, which said that they could not disclose information about anything they were doing. And we also think that this is an ongoing process. You need to have ongoing training for public affairs officers and scientists so they know what they're doing or not doing. So that's what we were calling for in our request for this. One of the ways that we did this was we had several of the agencies said, okay, we're going to put our draft policies out for public comment. We're very fortunate at the Union of Concerned Scientists. We have very large networks of activists and scientists who work with us. Maybe some of you are in the room. But we asked them to weigh in and comment on these. So the first time we did that with the Department of Interior Policy, we had 3,000 comments. When we did it for the Environmental Protection Agency, we had 24,000 comments. And when we did it for NOAA, we had over 17,000 from activists and 165 unique comments. So this had a big impression on the agencies. My friend, who was a colleague working inside Interior, they did put out their draft policy. It was terrible. He called me the next day and he said, well, nothing like 3,000 comments to get the minister's attention or the minister equivalent. So it does have a way of focusing the mind in a way. Okay, so the current status. So what's going on now with these scientific integrity policies? Basically, we have a handful of agencies that have released policies. Department of Interior, USDA, EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, NASA, and of course NOAA has released theirs. What we found, though, was that really, out of all of those agencies, NOAA and the National Science Foundation are the two that have really tread new ground in media policies. They've really gone far beyond what we were asking for and actually in creating a policy that would do that. So that's quite wonderful. The other thing is that we've had to stay on our, I think, sort of maybe the equivalent of Privy Council in our Office of Science and Technology Policy and our Office of Management and Budget, these offices within the White House. We've really had to stay on top of them to keep this moving. And in fact, 2 weeks ago, I, you know, phoned and asked about the status and really said, you know, gosh, guys, I really need to know what's happening next because I'm going to be talking at AAAS. And sure enough, 2 days ago, they came out with a blog post, which announced, or actually yesterday, that final or near final policies must be made public by March 30th. So they're coming. We're getting them very quickly. The NOAA policy very quickly is really one of the best. I think it's due to the leadership of Dr. Jane Lubchenco. It's really good to have a great scientist at the top of an agency thinking about these issues. But essentially, it encourages scientists to publish data and findings. NOAA will offer knowledgeable spokespersons if a reporter doesn't know who they need to call. But if a reporter knows who they need to call, then scientists may freely speak to the media and the public about the technical material that's based on their work. And if they want to express a personal opinion, they may do that by taking that personal views exception and disclaimer. We have gone on and continue to survey federal scientists, you know, and again, what we're finding now in our most recent survey of the FDA is that, in fact, there is still an enormous amount of confusion. Scientists are not sure how this works and what they need to be doing. So clearly, you know, the major challenge left to us is implementation. So I just to summarize very quickly how we got to this point, which is, I think, a really good place to be. We're moving in the right direction, you know, by exposing and bringing visibility to the examples. Document, document, document. Very important. We connected the censorship to the impacts on people's lives. This isn't an abstract issue. This is an issue that matters to people. We used congressional hearings to make agency heads accountable, in fact, very nervous. We made scientific integrity an election issue, an election issue. And we've kept the pressure on to really make these policies continue. So as I said, the current challenge is implementation. This is a huge task that we have ahead of us. And in fact, I'll be doing a symposium talk on Sunday at 8 a.m. specifically on this implementation piece and what that looks like. And we will have the folks in charge of this at a couple of our federal agencies there speaking. So I think that will be very interesting. Thank you.
That was Dr. Francesca Griffo from the Union of Concerned Scientists speaking at the 2012 meeting of the American Academy for the Advancement of Science on February 17th, as recorded by AVN.com.
Radio EcoShock.
At least scientists funded by the American government have a right to speak, something the Canadian government needs to learn. But plenty of pressure remains to keep the U.S. scientists quiet or minimize the risks, even as the climate tips us towards oblivion. As Griffo told the audience, it's still all about the money.
But I think there's one other elephant in the room that it's hard to not talk about, which is the enormous amounts of money that flow to campaigns, to elected officials, you know, at least in the U.S., I'm not speaking for Canada, but And that has a huge influence. I mean, we know, we've seen this with multiple decisions that were going to have profound impacts on one sector of industry, that in fact that sector was heavily lobbying the White House, meeting with them over and over again, meeting with the heads of agencies. In particular, when we went to regulate ozone, you know, we know that they were meeting with Lisa Jackson, the head of our Environmental Protection Agency. She stood strong, which is the good news. But then, in fact, the White House put off the decision because of the enormous pressure. And it's about money.
Get the Union of Concerned Scientists report, How Corporations Corrupt Science at the Public's Expense, from UCSUSA.org, UCSUSA.org, or find this and other links in my blog at ecoshock.info. Canadian climate scientist Andrew Weaver got a laugh as he explained why right-wing claims about a solid conspiracy by scientists around the world to push their agenda is so ludicrous.
No, that's a really good question. The problem there is scientists are by and large, a disorganized bunch of yahoos at lab benches.
No worse than journalists.
Yeah, who don't. But our organizations are typically not run. I mean, we have national organizations, and you have meteorological organizations in Canada and the U.S., but there, again, there's a fear of retribution at the organizational level, because these organizations often have charitable status. It doesn't seem to stop the Heartland Institute in the U.S., I seem, but it does it in Canada. They have
they get
branded radicals. They could have their taxable status challenge. So they have to, they typically are cautious. And as an individual scientist, never have been organized. I mean, the fact that there's an element of society that believes somehow there's a conspiracy of a cabal of scientists concocting a global warming problem is just bizarre. If anyone knows, you couldn't get half a dozen scientists in a room to agree that the sky is blue, let alone that global warming is an issue. So it's because we naturally don't organize, we naturally fight amongst ourselves. It's the nature of science, is to challenge, to fight, to be difficult. It's not to organize and provide a united front.
But do you have a sense that your colleagues in the government are frustrated?
Absolutely. More than frustrated. It's like last one out, turn out the lights. I would say once a month, get an email from somebody, a federal government scientist, saying, do you know any opportunities in the academic sector for someone like me? Because they're frustrated. Because they're frustrated because of the bureaucracy, because of the control, and because of morale. Morale is bad. When you control people, as scientists, the morale is bad. So absolutely, they're frustrated.
So that is why North Americans and some people down under don't believe we are facing climate disaster, even as the Arctic melts and crazy weather drowns or dries out the world. Big business and rich fanatics use charitable donations to create doubt in our minds. Since life is relatively easy, burning tons of fossil fuels, we like to believe them. The same powers that be buy off government officials or threaten countries with economic ruin if scientists explain our peril and what we need to do to avoid a calamity. Governments and universities muzzle their scientists or discourage anyone from speaking out. Everybody has an economic interest in not talking about this. Since life is relatively easy, we like to believe the candy-coated lies, accept the propaganda, and get used to the silencing of truth. That's how it is on a faraway planet somewhere in the Milky Way. Reporting from planet Earth, this is Alex Smith. Visit our website at ecoshock.org, and thank you for listening. We'll let George Michael say what needs to be said. Freedom.